The content of the following broadcast is offered as is and confers no rights or warranties. The opinions expressed here are solely those of the participants and may not reflect those of the Microsoft Corporation, its partners, friends, and family. Welcome to IT Heroes. And now here's your host, Michael J. Murphy.
And ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of IT Heroes Stories from the Trenches. My name is Michael Murphy, and these are the real stories of the men and women making a difference in IT every day. It's a pleasure to have with us on the program today, Ben Sarabin. Ben, welcome.
Thank you.
Ben is the founder and chief technology officer of Reef Solutions, a network technology consulting company based in New York City. Ben is also involved in a number of organizations. He's the founder and chief exchange evangelist for the New York Exchange Users Group, the only New York City metro area Microsoft Exchange group. He's one of the founders of New York City Wireless, which I'm really excited about, and I want to talk to you about that today, Ben. For those of you that have not heard of New York City Wireless, or if you're not in the New York area, this is a leading nonprofit wireless group that's responsible for such high-profile wireless networks as the Bryant Park Wi-Fi network, which we should definitely talk about today. And Ben has also served on the technology committee for the Manhattan Chamber of Commerce. So, Ben, I'm really excited to have you here today. It's a pleasure to be talking with you. You're in New York, or no, you're in D.C. today.
Correct, I am, actually.
Now, what are you doing down in D.C.?
Oh, I was speaking at a conference for the executive offices industry. They have an international conference this time of year, so I was brought down to talk a little bit about technology that's on the horizon.
And what were you guys talking about last night?
We focused heavily on voice over IP.
Uh-huh.
So, but there were a couple other topics that we were going to talk about that just more on the data side of things, and that was just some of the enhancements that are coming in the next year or two.
And now it's interesting. Voice over IP is a fascinating technology to me. And I note that in the marketplace, the rate of adoption doesn't seem, it's not taking off the way that I would expect it to. What kind of factors do you see in the marketplace that are contributing to that slower than maybe anticipated growth?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that was actually very interesting was it's amazing that the co-speaker who was speaking with me mentioned that actually voice over IP, 50% of all new phone ports on new phone systems are actually voice over IP capable. The funny thing is, or not the funny, the sad thing is that something like 15% are actually being utilized for that purpose.
Right.
One of the difficulties with voice over IP is just it's very difficult to quantify the cost savings implementing it over traditional phone systems.
And now I would think that if it cost me $50,000 to put a voice over IP system in place and I have a $25,000 a month phone bill, I would expect that I would be able to calculate my cost savings pretty quickly, even given, you know, the cost of maintenance and management of that system.
Yeah, this is one of the myths about voice over IP.
Ah, we'll dispel a myth.
Exactly. There's actually, I mean, when most people think of voice over IP, they think of some of the smaller carriers. Well, not smaller, but some of the consumer carriers, such as Vonage
Skype.
And Skype and things of that nature. And they always think free. When usually the first thing that comes to mind is voice over IP, free or very low cost. And in the enterprise world, it's really a different animal. It's not the voice over IP that we think of, the consumers, but actually the enterprises, it all integrates. It's really voice over IP, all that really means when you talk about enterprise mm-hmm. is that it's utilizing the data network for calls. And so you still have to actually call, you have to connect into the public telephone system, the PSTN.
Mm-hmm.
So every time you make a call, the call still costs money. It still costs the same amount of money, too, frequently.
Really?
Yeah. So there's no real, because it's like, you know, if you call your friend in California using, you know, an enterprise voice over IP system, it's not going from voice over IP to another voice over IP system. It's going from your voice over IP system to a traditional landline.
Right.
And so you're not seeing really a cost savings there, the cost savings has to be made internally, meaning that if you have multiple branch offices and you call between the branch offices, there, that's a cost savings. That costs nothing, because that's actually just using internet bandwidth between the two. The other benefit of Voice over IP is having, you know, a lot of times people are traveling, so they'll take phones with them, and that phone will travel with them. Or if you have a home office for some of the executives, an extension within the company, but now it's at your home. So it allows you to be a lot more flexible and more productive, and that's very hard to quantify when, you know, phone vendors say, you know, this Voice over IP system is $100,000, and a traditional analog phone system is, you know, $60,000.
Or is even already in place.
And that was one of the things that we really talked about, you know, because that's a lot of questions. A lot of these executive offices, a lot of their tenants come in and they ask, you know, do you have a Voice over IP phone system? Not realizing, you know, what that means. They just think new technology. I want to go to some place that has new technology.
So the reality of Voice over IP is that we only derive the benefit when we're going to another IP phone.
Correct, exactly.
And so if I've got to call landlines, I'm not going to see those benefits.
Correct.
But if I'm in an environment where I have international offices, I have 25 international offices dispersed around the globe, and I make lots of inter-office phone calls, there I could see a real savings.
Huge. I mean, for the large global enterprise, it's a no-brainer. I mean, they'll make back the money. Their return on investment will be a lot faster than a U.S.-only company, just because telephone rates within the continental U.S. are very, very low, and it makes it very difficult to gain, just based on phone calls, the cost savings over the long term. So this the return on investment for U.S.-based companies just on phone calls would take years. If ever. But for international, you can make it back pretty quickly.
That's great insight. Now, tell me, what else were you talking about last night?
One of the other things that was, well, that I would have liked to talk about was just on the horizon, smarter switches and bandwidth shaping.
Now, what's bandwidth shaping? That's a term that I'm not familiar with. That's a brand new term to me. What is that?
Yeah, bandwidth shaping is, it's a device or software that can actually prioritize different types, different classes of traffic intelligently. So this isn't frequently firewalls. There'll be rules in a firewall that says, you know, all port 80 traffic is considered, you know, priority 3. Priority 2 is, you know, all traffic over 25, which is, you know, SMTP. The problem is that a lot of the peer-to-peer applications and instant messenger applications have actually started funneling data over port 80. So people realize that it's the, you know, hole in the firewall and that people aren't paying attention to it.
Or as I like to call it, the universal hacking port.
Exactly, the universal hacking port. So the way to combat this is, a lot of times firewalls aren't smart enough to do this, or, you know, switches or, you know, static rules can't do this. So there are devices and software called packet shaping solutions that actually inspect each packet and look at the packet and say, you know, this, you know, say, instant messenger packet, this isn't, you know, HTTP traffic over port 80. This is actually IM. And then you'd have a set of rules, a priority list, and you would go down the list and where's the IM traffic priority? And it might be number 5.
So low.
It would be low, so all the other traffic, such as, you know, SMTP, if you have such as, you know,
business critical web applications.
Exactly, those will get higher priorities, and so this is something that's very important, because a lot of the peer-to-peer, they constantly change, you know, they jump around ports, and it's very difficult. You can't block a particular port for peer-to-peer, and so bandwidth shaping can take all that info and say, you know, we're going to give it a max of 10K. Even though we might have a T1, we're going to say 10K only. Or you can completely block it. That's another technique. And that was actually very interesting, just because at the conference, one of the folks that attend are very profit-oriented, because a lot of times their margins aren't as high as other industries. So if something doesn't, you know, if they don't see the profit in it, they're not going to really go ahead with it. So,
which, I mean, that's what drives all of our decisions, right? I mean, ultimately, even if you're a pure tech guy, you've got to go to management. You've got to get their buy-in to get them to write the check. And so ultimately, that bottom line is going to drive all of our decision making.
Yep.
Now, that's really interesting. It's a new technology. It's something that I'm not familiar with. I can see the potential for it, certainly. You know, this ability to be able to distinguish and prioritize traffic regardless of the port number. Is the methodology based on a heuristic analysis of the traffic? Or the characteristics of the packet?
Yeah, it actually, there's a couple of factors, how it actually classifies this, and it's not an open standard.
Okay.
So the vendors, the various bandwidth shaping vendors, do it in a different way, just because frequently it's, you know, a cat and mouse game.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the peer-to-peer vendors don't want to be classified.
Right.
So this is the type of thing.
And are trying to avoid detection.
Correct. So this is the type of thing where all these bandwidth shaping, they're constantly updates made to it. I mean, it's similar to, Windows updates or Office updates. You have to, that's actually not a good analogy. It's more like antivirus updates.
Okay.
New viruses coming out, you know, they're always tweaking their application. So that's how they go about, you know, figuring out what type of traffic it is.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Now, I want to talk. So you had a good time in D.C. last night, and you obviously had some great conversation down there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to come back to your home city, New York City, and I want to talk a little bit about New York City Wireless. You're on the board or were on the board. Are you still on the board for New York City Wireless?
Yep. Okay. Still on the board. So.
And I used to work in the Grace Building. So before 2-2, I was in the Grace Building, which is right across the street from Bryant Park. And it was great working in the Grace Building, you know, at lunch in the spring and the summer and the fall. You'd go over to Bryant Park, sit in the grass under the trees in the middle of New York City, right there in the shadow of the New York Public Library. And I was often frustrated because if I was having a busy day or had work to get done, I couldn't go to the park. I had to stay in the, and we were in the basement, Ben. You know, we were in the basement of the Grace Building. So I had to stay in the basement and work through lunch. Then New York City Wireless came along and freed me. You know, Bryant Park went wireless. I was able to take my laptop, go over there, have my lunch outdoors, make a break from the office, and it was just phenomenal. What was that project like? What was it like working on that project? I know from an end user perspective the benefits that I derived, but tell me what it was like getting that thing up and running.
Yeah, I mean, like you were saying, an end user, I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful option for a park to have wireless. It was actually, there was a lot of, it took about a year to get this project up and running. There were just a lot of issues such as physical issues about the equipment, cabling issues. Then there was the whole thing about the effect on neighbors. I mean, the project went back and forth about maintaining it. It literally took a year to work out all these issues.
And I'm sure that, I mean, clearly you had to work very closely with the New York City government.
Well, it's actually, that's the funny thing. I mean, I guess I should, actually, Bryant Park is actually run by a not-for-profit.
I did not know that.
Yeah, called the Bryant Park Restoration Corporation.
Hmm.
So there are certain parks throughout the city that are run by these private organizations, separate from the city parks. So we actually didn't even need to communicate with the New York City Parks Department.
That's fascinating. Well, that's why it only took a year then.
Exactly. That's why it only took a year. But, yeah, so once we addressed all their issues, then we were pretty much smooth sailing. And the funny thing is it took a year to, you know, deal with all these issues, and it took about a week or a little bit less, maybe 4 days to deploy the network.
Really?
Yeah, so.
And so does the Bryant Park, what did you call it, the Bryant Park?
Restoration Corporation.
Do they manage and maintain the infrastructure?
Correct. So the New York City Parks Department, I don't think, pays anything. This Bryant Park Restoration Corporation gets all their money. They fund from when, an example, like, you know, Microsoft, some of the Microsoft launch parties were actually held in Bryant Park. So they pay Bryant Park, you know, Restoration Corporation for use of the park. So those funds are what help sustain the park and all the upgrades, such as, you know, HBO has their movies in the park.
Every February during Fashion Week, the models are in the park.
Exactly. So that helps raise funds, and that's why this park is actually has a decent budget and can do a lot of the things other parks can't afford to do.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty impressive what they're able to do with that park.
That's great. Now, I want to talk, we're just about out of time here, so before we go, I want to talk a little bit about the New York Exchange Users Group, which you are president and founder of as well. That's an organization, that's a group that I've been really pleased to have spoken at, to have been involved with some. Can you tell me a little bit about how that's going and what it's like building that community in New York City?
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, it's very exciting. I mean, email is a real passion of mine, just on the email server side of things. So, I mean, it was a great opportunity to actually create this user group. Which
it was unbelievable to me that there was no Exchange user group in New York before just, when did you start this, last year?
Yeah, a little bit less than last year.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, I think, 9 months ago. I mean, I was attending a lot of other user groups, computer user groups, and we would every so often touch on, you know, Exchange or email-based technology. And I couldn't get enough of it. And so, you know, I approached, you know, a couple of folks from the other user groups, and I said, you know, I'd really like to, you know, start up this group. I think there's a lot of individuals that could really benefit from learning about, you know, email and specifically Exchange. I mean, Exchange is a very powerful mail server, and people don't realize that, and I don't think utilize it to its fullest capabilities.
And what's the web address for your group?
It is nyexug.com.
So www.nyexug.com. And you meet the second Tuesday of every month?
Correct.
At the Microsoft offices at 1290 6th Avenue.
Yep. And that also includes free dinner. So it's open to the public. And definitely check it out. Sign up online. It's a great resource. And we have people that are heavily involved in, you know, managing Exchange day-to-day. And we have, you know, CTOs and people who are just starting to learn about Exchange. So it's a great group. It really is.
Free dinner, free wireless. Ben, how do you do it all?
Let me tell you, it's tricky. You really have to prioritize. I mean, those are the... I think Exchange is more of a love of my life, which is just funny because people just consider it a tool to communicate. I think it's amazing. I mean, people don't realize email is now more mission critical than phone.
You know, I often ask the question to folks, think about where you were 10 years ago. Did you have email in your business 10 years ago? Did you even have an internet connection? And most of the time, folks say no, they didn't. In 1995, they didn't have that. Now you ask that question, and if email is down, the whole business stops.
Yeah, no, it's, I take a lot more for a lot of our clients. Email is the number one app internally, and
right.
So we'll do a lot to make sure that's up and running. Phone, we don't really have typically redundancy on phones, unless you're doing voice over IP, which is another benefit of voice over IP, the redundancy. But email is what gets all the redundancy focus.
Well, Ben, I really want to thank you for taking the time to be with us today. It was a pleasure talking to you. I am Michael Murphy, and this is IT Heroes, Stories from the Trenches, the real stories of the men and women making a difference in IT every day. Ben, thank you so much.
Thank you.
IT Heroes, with your host, Michael J. Murphy, was recorded at Matador Studios in Monmouth Junction, New Jersey. Produced and engineered by Giles Davis. Original music performed and composed by Giles Davis.